How do we go about the task of deciding right from wrong? Hello, this is Good Word. I'm your host, Dave Thomas. We continue on in our series of discussions about origins, the big question of origins, the ideas that swirl around that and also emerge from it. And today, I'm here again with some colleagues, Alden Thompson and Bob Cushman. Alden is a biblical scholar. Bob Cushman is a scientist. And gentlemen, thank you for joining me here today. We come to this fascinating question that in all human beings, there seems to be this moral sense. And if you've ever read C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, you know that he begins that book by making quite a big deal about that. I assign that book in some of the classes I teach, and it never ceases to amaze me how striking that foundational understanding is for students, because it's pretty hard to argue that human beings have no moral sense. So I guess the question I throw out to you today is, where does this moral sense come from? Especially that's a question if we don't have a creator. What's the significance of it? How do we go about the task of deciding right from wrong? I'm anxious to hear your comments.
Well, however it got there, it seems to be reflected, at least in some sense, in most human beings, except those who are, should we say, have seared their consciences completely.
Mm-hmm. And that is possible to do, it seems.
Yeah.
So your point is what? Did you mean if absent a creator, it's hard to know how that would get there?
Well, the more important observation for me is that if God is my creator and my father, then all creatures are his children and my brothers and sisters. For me, that is a powerful motivator for doing what is right.
Okay. I understand your point. That's a good point. I like that point. So what if there is no creator? Then what do we do?
Well, there is a field of science that considers some of these types of questions, and they would argue that morality and a sense of altruism could develop through behavioral means if it benefits the person who is moral. If it has some kind of benefit to them, then it could have developed through generations.
But so much of our moral behavior is not beneficial to us, especially when it involves issues of conscience. You know, I mean, oftentimes conscience is contrary to cultural convention, and if you want to hold to your conscience, then it becomes very detrimental. So I understand your point, and I'm not here to pick it apart, except a little bit.
So are you saying that our conscience only helps us decide when we're doing wrong and not when we're doing right?
No, what I'm saying is that I think your conscience is just an alarm system that tells you when you violated some principles that you hold. I don't think it tells you whether those principles are right or not. In other words, I can recite to you examples. Like I read a book about a culture where people idealized treachery. Mm-hmm. It was a tribe in New Guinea called the Sawa tribe. It's a very interesting book called The Peace Child. And when you read that book, it's horrifying because it begins with a story of somebody who befriended somebody and then goes to trade with them and then murders them in cold blood and goes back a hero. And the most amazing part of the story is when the missionary comes there and he tells the story of Jesus and the betrayal of Jesus and the death of Jesus, and everybody's completely captivated by Judas because they've never heard of anybody who could, for 3.5 years, live with somebody and then betray them to their death. I mean, it was like Judas is the hero. So, you know, you wonder, they still had consciences, but the reference point of their consciences was backward or upside down compared to us. So,
their concept of right and wrong was reversed.
Yeah. And so, and by the way, their tribe was in significant decline because they had only enemies. How do you make friends with people who idealize treachery? So, I think your point is an interesting one, but conscience only polices the beliefs that you have already. It doesn't tell you whether those beliefs are good or not necessarily. Alden, you have a quizzical look on your face.
Well, I'm just thinking of a comment which our former colleague in history, Roland Blyke, points out, and I think he's right. You must always act according to your conscience. Now, your conscience may be wrong.
Yeah.
But you dare not go contrary to that conscience. Now, all of us, I suppose, are in the task of remaking our consciences by stories of the Bible and by help from others. But until that has been retrained, you don't dare go against your conscience.
Yeah, and the reason for that, I think, is plain, that that's how you destroy a conscience.
Mm-hmm.
So conscience really has two issues. One is the function of the alarm system, and the other is what it's protecting.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is really about how do you find the ingredients that conscience or the points of reference that conscience oversees? See, and I think all of us would agree that in the presence of a creator, those would be supplied.
Mm-hmm.
Correct? But what happens if there's not a creator? What do we do then?
Well, see, that's very difficult for me to understand because I consider myself an incurably religious person. I don't know that I could survive in a world where there is no God. So once you assume that there is a God, then you ask, how does that help me in the world in which I live?
Mm-hmm.
And I think especially when you see that Jesus Christ is the incarnation of that God and everything that Jesus Christ did for us,
yeah.
For me, that is a powerful motivator to treat you the way I would want to be treated if I were in your place.
Yeah, we had this old saying, and it doesn't work anymore because we are more egalitarian than we used to be, but this, the brotherhood of mankind.
Yeah.
And we don't have a good word to replace that, but the connectedness, yeah. Very interesting. I want to raise another question that's an American question, is that we have in our founding documents here this statement of the existence of inalienable rights. But if you read those are inalienable rights that we our founders understood to be given us by our Creator. So what happens to inalienable rights if there is no Creator? See? And we tend as a society to be moving away from the idea of a Creator. We are moving in some very un-Protestant directions and even un-Christian directions. And I do wonder, because it seems to me those inalienable rights were perceived to be within the particular context of the existence of a Creator. If there is no Creator, then how do we have inalienable rights anymore? And I know that's kind of a political question, but
what might be an example when you think of those that would be tied back to a Creator?
Well, one is the right of conscience, the right of religious belief. I do wonder what the future of religious liberty is in our country, because absent a Creator, religion actually becomes an annoyance. You know, I guess the real challenge that comes to my mind is that are we self-referenced or are we better referenced by external points? And see, I think that the central question here about creation and morality raises this very question in my mind, because if you don't have a Creator who establishes some code of right and wrong, then we're left to establish it by ourselves. And how you can then claim that that has any ultimate significance is beyond me, because it might have local significance. Maybe in this room we agree we won't kill each other, but how's that binding on everybody else? See, we might agree that we share a common life, but what about those outside? And beyond that, I wonder about how well we as human beings do when we are self-referenced. You know, how do you have a common good if everybody's self-referenced?
Just to be the devil's advocate here, some of the greatest destruction in the world is done by religious people. And that's why some of the atheists today say we'd be much better off without religion. See?
Well, you open a big can of worms all then, because the most destructive ideology in all history has been atheism. In the 20th century, it was responsible for about 150 to 170 million adverse deaths, just communism alone, which is many, many times more than have been killed by religionists. I would argue, by the way, that that atheism is a form of religion anyway, so mm-hmm. That argument gets into trouble very quickly in my mind. But I see your point.
So the take-home message might be that as humans, we've been a pretty messy job of following our consciences, or at least in an effective job of following our consciences.
Yeah. Well,
when it comes to religion, whether it's belief in God or something else. Yeah.
See, the struggle, if you have reference points outside yourself, the struggle then is not to become arrogant and say, well, I know what the reference points are and you're not doing them, so then you have to die. And I think that's been the fault of religious people. The struggle the other way is if we're all self-referenced, then there is really no binding sense of morality. Everybody will do what they decide to do. And right. You know, tolerance and the idea of letting everybody do their own thing becomes the cardinal virtue. And I'm not sure societies thrive when you have all these autonomous selves running around. How do you agree on what a society is going to be? So, you know, we have misgovernment either way. So, anyway. Some challenging questions. I would not want to suggest that the existence of a creator who provides some kind of moral structure for life is the answer to all things, because, you know, first of all, we have the problem of human understanding and how well we understand that. And secondly, we have the problem of human arrogance. So, Alden, I wanted to ask you a question, a biblical question. What is this thing about the image of God? And does it have any connection to morality? We have only a short time here. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, the theologians have debated a fair bit. The image of God, does that include a physical component? But you ask about the moral component. Mm. I'm inclined to think that when God created man and let us make man in our image, that is a pretty broad footprint. Mm-hmm. Which would include morality, creative powers, the service element, and of course you see that most clearly when Jesus comes, that God is seen to be the one who provides the sacrifice. And you get that even in the story of Abraham on the mountain when he was trying to sacrifice Isaac. God basically says, you can't really sacrifice your son. I will provide the sacrifice for you.
Yeah.
So you get that image of a God who gives is a very powerful one, and I think that is reflected in God's creatures, at least mm-hmm. ideally.
So this image of God might be kind of a default, a description of default settings in human life,
mm-hmm.
and I do think that those exist. I mean, you can see that a very wicked person may have a righteous child, so to speak, from mm-hmm. the beginning. So it does look like God in his grace, if you allow for the existence of God, has protected us from a unending descent into
yep.
wickedness by that. So. Well, some interesting questions. I suppose there are some other ones that we could think about, and I don't mean to pretend that we have done justice to the non-creationist side of this debate. I'm sure that there are people who would argue that there's actually much more substantial basis for a morality without God than we have represented, but so it is. Thank you very much for joining me again today to chat after her, our engineer. We give thanks also. And to those of you who listen in, thank you. For Good Word, I'm David Thomas.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.